genius.
The fully realized vision of an authentic American genius.
We need your brains.
Don't you have a brain in your head?
Oh, then I will have to adjust your brain a bit.
Every day, Billy the Brain talks with the best guests in America.
Cool.
About business.
The boss that works for you.
Entertainment. Sports.
Turn now to sports.
And the local community.
Radio keeps its eye on local events.
It's time for brainstorming.
My brain is like mush.
With Billy the Brain.
Sounds like fun. Let's go.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Self, you'll know that he did nothing short of a miracle. On September the 7th, 1979, ESPN went on the air for the first time. Entrepreneurial, daring, irrepressible enthusiasm, although some might say irresponsible as well, with a dash of good luck, gave the world its first 24-hour television network. The man who had this dream, the founder of ESPN, is Bill Rasmussen. 31 years ago, this man changed the landscape of sports in America forever. In the process, he also changed television, advertising, and sports players' salaries. If you're remotely interested in sports, television, or advertising, you can join in the conversation by calling us at 639-0008. Bill Rasmussen is a lifelong entrepreneur and sports fan. His innovations in advertising, sports, and broadcast are numerous, including the creation of SportsCenter, the wall-to-wall coverage of the NCAA regular season and March Madness college basketball, and coverage of the NFL draft. For his many accomplishments, Rasmussen has been named to the Sports 100, honoring the 100 most important people in American sports history. His place in sports history was further recognized by Sports Illustrated in 1994 when he was honored as one of the top 40 of the ages, one of 40 individuals who significantly altered and elevated the world of sport during the second half of the 20th century. USA Today calls Bill the father of cable sports. Welcome to the show, Bill. How are you today?
Just fine. I'm just listening to you as you were talking about all this stuff. I've got to be old to have done all those things, and I don't feel old.
Well, I'm glad that you don't feel old. You are definitely an icon in our household for what you did with ESPN. We thank you for that on a daily basis, being a sports junkie as I am. In fact, the term sports junkie is something that you and your son Scott actually coined the phrase, didn't you?
Actually, yes, that's true. He actually came up with that. He was doing an interview, I think it was with TV Guide or one of the magazines of the day, and they just didn't get the idea of 24-hour sports. And he said, look, this is just for sports junkies. He said, nothing else. That's all we're going to have on it, sports. And so that they wrote the story, and the phrase sports junkies caught on. And obviously, here we are 30 years later, 31 years later now, still saying the same thing.
Well, it's an amazing thing. ESPN's been around, as you say, for 31 years. There's a whole generation, including Charlie Smith, who's joining me in the studio to listen to this interview. There's a whole generation out there who grew up not knowing ESPN was around. I mean, that's the impact that you've had on American society. Do you consider yourself a radical or a revolutionary?
Not really. The very practical reason that ESPN got started is I was working for the Hartford Whalers, and the old WHA got fired, and we had to look for something to do, and we've been talking a little bit about cable television, and the timing was just right because the satellite transponder delivery of television signals was a totally new idea. Nobody had any idea what it was, and I'm one of those folks who says, well, let's look at this and try it, where other people say, well, we want to make sure it works before we try it. So we jumped in, and all of a sudden people said, wow, we can do this, and it's pretty inexpensive to distribute across the country. And as they say, the rest is history. We went on the air in September of 1979, and when we did the March Madness basketball that following spring in March of 1980, March and April, everybody kind of sat up and said, wow, where did this come from? And then right around that same time, CNN got underway with Ted Turner. HBO expanded to 24 hours, and the race was on. And it has just been a kind of a nightmare for the network TV, big networks. But cable television has just exploded everywhere in news and sports and weather and just anything you can imagine because of that satellite that went up in the late 70s and the ability to jump in and try something new.
And I think it is your ability, Bill, to try something new that others were not willing to do that really makes you revolutionary, at least in my mind. So I think that that's great. Something that I found interesting that ESPN really was not only because you were fired from the Whalers, the Hartford Whalers, but also this is something that had been in your blood for a long time. You didn't just come to sports. You have had a lifelong love of sports. You laugh, but tell us a little bit about that.
That's true. I was talking to someone just yesterday, and they said, when did you ever get involved in sports on an organized basis? And I remember being invited to play for the 8th grade softball team when I was a 5th grader, so I guess I started back in the early 40s.
Wow.
But I played baseball and softball for about pretty close to 45 years, and wanted to be a sports broadcaster. I wanted to be a sports a third baseman for the Chicago White Sox is where I thought I would be. But then the Korean War came along, and I ended up in the military. By the time I got out, we had our first son, and I was much too old to be a rookie. So sports broadcasting was the next best thing, and I actually got into sports broadcasting on the radio in 1962. And so I did that for a while, did 10 years of sports television as an evening sportscaster, did a lot of play-by-play for the better part of 15 years in hockey and baseball, football, and basketball. And so it was not new when the idea hit in 1978. I knew a lot of the people at the NCAA by that time and a lot of college conferences and a lot of college athletic directors. So it just seemed a very logical thing for me to say, wow, we've got all these sports clips, and now we've got this new idea with transponder and the satellite. Got to be a marriage there somewhere, and we weren't quite sure each morning when we woke up just exactly how it was working out every day, but we kept at it.
Well, we're talking to Bill Rasmussen, everybody. In case you don't know, he's the founder of ESPN. And truly, a lot of things came together for you, Bill, with the RCA transponder, the satellites that were up there, and everything else. In reading your book, the thing that I found most interesting from a business angle was the seed money to get started. Tell us, how much did you have in seed money to get all of ESPN Network, as we know it today, up and going in the old days?
Well, the step-by-step is pretty easy. We had to take a $9,000 credit card advance so we could rent some space to do some business. And the quick answer is we got that $9,000 credit card advance plus $146 million from Getty Oil, and we had an instant network. Of course, it wasn't quite that easy. Along the way, we had to borrow money from relatives, and we had a small investment banking firm that helped us discover Getty, actually. But we really launched and got to the Getty money, if you will, with about $300,000 from family and friends and this small investment firm. And then Getty, once they made the decision to buy our remote fleet, which is a $10 million ticket, and to hire people and really put the network on the air, was another $10 million. And then they just kept adding money until it turned around in the mid-'80s. And then it was acquired by Texaco and ultimately by ABC.
And now ultimately is owned by Disney, isn't that correct?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep, and went from ABC to Cap Cities, acquired ABC, and then Disney acquired Cap Cities, and then all of the twisting fates and fortunes of folks. The a vice president from ABC Sports is now the chairman of the board at Disney, Bob Iger.
There you go. It's a strange and convoluted world, isn't it?
It is.
It is. All right, well, those of us that are in the media know that content, no matter how good it is, must be supported by advertising. So tell us a little bit about how you wooed advertisers to your fledgling network.
Well, we had what we thought was an absolutely brilliant plan of we thought that for some 20 some odd million dollars we could support ourselves, and so we divided whatever that number was by eight. We thought we'd go get eight sponsors. So the advantage of not having any knowledge whatsoever about how they're going to receive this 24-hour network gave us all kinds of freedom to think. So we came up with an advertising package that was worth $2,760,000, called New York, the advertising agency for Budweiser, and said, you've got to talk to us. This is the greatest thing that you're ever going to buy, because Budweiser is the biggest sports advertiser then and still today, I think.
Yes.
And so we went down to talk to the fellow, and he looked at us like we were, I guess, from Mars or someplace. He said, let me think about that. And he called us. We were back in a day, and he said, I talked to them in St. Louis, and we'll give you $500,000. And now, mind you, at that point, we were working off our $9,000 credit card advance. He said he's going to give us $500,000, and we said, nope, we've got to do better than that, so we'll go someplace else.
You said no to $500,000? You said no to $500,000, Bill?
Yeah, we're just walking away. Can you believe that? I can't believe it today.
Yeah, that's daring right there.
The next day, we got a call from him. He said, can you come back? We were just up in Bristol, Connecticut. He said, can you come back down and meet with me? And we went back down, and he said, you know what? We're gonna offer you $1,380,000, and we want exclusivity, and we'll work out all the details later. Can you live with that? Well, we said no to $500,000. We weren't going to say no to $1,380,000.
Good.
And that was the amazing thing about that, though, was it was in January of 1979, 9 months before we ever went on the air. And the deal was completed and announced, and that helped. Obviously, when somebody like Budweiser, in effect, jumped on our bandwagon, that helped with other advertisers. It helped with cable systems. It helped with the NCAA, who we were trying to get major programming from. So it was a very, very significant move when Gene Patrillo is the gentleman's name. I'll never forget him, a vice president for the agency. And he said, that's what we're going to do. We'll go out to St. Louis and work out the details out there later this spring. And we did. And they went on the air. And that was that.
Getting Budweiser to come on board clearly was a major, major turning point for you. You've probably read the book, Malcolm Gladwell's The Tipping Point. Every successful venture has a tipping point where it catapults forward. What was the tipping point for ESPN, would you say?
Well, before we went on the air or after, there are two very, obviously, Budweiser and the agreement with the NCAA before we ever even were 6 or 8 months from going on the air gave us incredible reputation and credence and so on. But the tipping point from a viewer's point of view had to be the March Madness in the spring of 1980. People just had no idea, and as soon as, you know, basketball fans are kind of off the charts sometimes, and as soon as they discovered that they could watch everything other than just the Saturday afternoon or Saturday night network games, they just went crazy. We were getting calls from everywhere, and our subscription rate, the number of people signing up with cable systems and the cable systems calling us saying, how do we do this? How do we get a hold of you guys? It just skyrocketed, starting with March Madness in 1980, and actually in September of 1980, 1 year later.
Hello, Bill, you there? Bill, you there? Hello, Bill. Hang on, Bill. We're losing you there. Can you hear us?
Oh, yeah, I hear you fine.
Okay, great. Now you're back. You're back. You were saying in September of 1980.
Yeah, in September of 1980, we had nearly 6 million subscribers come online, which back then was huge. It was the biggest single month of new subscribers to any service in the history of cable television.
And what was it in September?
September 1980, just a year after we went on the air.
Amazing.
So it was just an incredible period of time. Had we been a year earlier or perhaps a year later, who knows what would have happened.
Sure. Bill, we're going to have to take a break here for just some commercials in just a second, but I've got to ask you, and you mentioned this in passing just a moment ago, that you were located up in Bristol, Connecticut. Why Bristol?
Well, we actually rented space from United Cable Television in Plainville, Connecticut, which is right next door. They share a common border. And believe it or not, it's hard to believe in this day and age, Plainville, Connecticut passed an ordinance that would not allow us to put a satellite receiver inside their city limits. Bristol had a redevelopment area that was a direct line of sight to where we were, and the United Cable said, we're going to go over and look at that land. You want to come along, basically? And they said, they bought a little slice of land. The attorney for Bristol came down and said, we'll make you a great deal if you move to Bristol. And we did.
We're talking.
That was about as simple as it was.
We're talking to Bill Rasmussen, everybody, the founder of ESPN, a man who changed the landscape of television, of advertising, and of sports as we know it. We've got to take a short break, Bill. We'll be right back after these commercials.
And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
You know, I think your brain produces a chemical that blocks out my voice.
What? Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
In case you don't recognize that sound, everybody, that's the sound of ESPN Sports. This is Bill Frank. You're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. My special guest today is Bill Rasmussen. He is the founder of ESPN, and our theme today is saving lives. And I'll tell you, ESPN saved my life because I love March Madness, and ESPN put March Madness on the map. Bill, before we went away to the commercial break, we were talking about some of the more memorable things that in the early startup of ESPN. You've got a book out, which is titled Sports Junkies Rejoice, The Birth of ESPN. And where can people go to find that to learn more about those early days?
Well, obviously, I have a website, ESPNFounder.com. It's available there. It's available at Amazon. And ask for it at a bookstore, and if they don't have it, they will get it for you.
That is great. And it is a good read, everybody. If you like sports, if you like television, or if you like advertising, it's all in there for you. Now, Bill, I've got to ask you, what stands out as the most memorable person or event in ESPN's early history?
Well, it might surprise you. I had a conversation in the summer before we went on the air with Pete Rozelle, who was then commissioner of the National Football League.
Sure.
Now, you have to understand, we were months before we went on the air, we were trying to sell the idea, we were talking to a lot of people, and I was quite surprised, actually, that he agreed to meet with us because, you know, we were just little guys, and he was very thoughtful, he was very courteous, and he really asked serious questions and said, as I was leaving, you know, thanked me for coming in and said, not today, but someday we'll be on ESPN. That stuck in my mind because he was a gentleman and because of the seriousness with which he took it. Major League Baseball didn't pay much attention at that time. The NBA didn't much care. We were doing a little bit of hockey, but they were a bit disorganized. But when Pete said that, I thought, wow, we really must have something going here, because he was a well-respected commissioner of, obviously, the NFL. And it wasn't very long after that. A few years later, they did get ESPN got a part of a Sunday night package, and then, of course, just a couple of years ago, amazingly, Monday Night Football is now on ESPN. And from a pure personal point of view, the tingle, the almost tears in my eyes that I heard when I watched the very first game, Monday Night Football on ESPN, and when we heard that, you know, for Monday Night Football, that was pretty impressive.
Oh, I bet it made the hairs on your arms stand up. That is incredible.
It did indeed.
Yeah. Now, you know, today we think of ESPN really truly as this institution in America, and it is. There's no question about that. But looking back on it, you know, we think of it as, oh, it's been around forever. There had to have been adversities as you were coming along with ESPN. What were some of the adversities you had to overcome?
Oh, there was no question. Obviously, money was one. At the beginning, getting cable operators to believe that this was the new wave. Remember, up until really CNN, or not CNN, but Ted Turner Superstation, then ultimately CNN and ESPN and the others came along, cable television was really a signal enhancement. They didn't much care about programming. They just wanted to be able to get the signal in and send it out to as many customers and collect whatever it was, $10 or $12 or $15 a month from those subscribers who couldn't ordinarily get all the over-the-air pictures from the three networks that they wanted. So we had to convince them that people really did want to hear about other things like sports all day and news. And that's the way we sold it, was the networks program your life for you. We're going to let you program your life for you. If you want to watch sports at 2 in the morning or 3 in the afternoon, or you want to catch up on the news at 1:15 in the morning or whatever it might be, we'll be there for you. Unlike Monday night movie on NBC at 9 o'clock. If you can't make it at 9, you can't see the movie. Well, HBO gives you movies 24 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
So we went out and sold it. And that, I think once we got over the hump of everybody saying, oh, now I get it, we're going to be able to go watch sports 24 hours a day, and watch sports anytime during the 24-hour period. We don't have to sit down and watch it 24 hours a day. I never understood that theory. When we say we're going to do this 24 hours, people say, who's going to watch sports 24 hours a day?
Yeah.
Nobody.
That's right.
Nobody watched NBC 18 hours a day. Once we got past that, it became, you know, the proverbial snowball going downhill and just kept going faster and faster and getting bigger and bigger.
We're talking to Bill Rasmussen, everybody. He is the founder of ESPN, and he's got some fantastic stories to tell about the early days of that. For those of us who are a little bit older, I remember some of the early programming that you had on there, too, and I wanted to ask you about a couple of them, because how did you get the rights to such previously obscure sports as Irish hurling and Aussie rules football?
I think I was wondering if you're going to mention Bruce Herling, because I think we played all of the oxide and everything off that tape. We ran a tape of something from Limerick, Ireland, over and over again. They actually fed that tape to us. We didn't pay anything for that one.
No kidding.
We actually didn't pay very much for all of the regular season NCAA basketball and football tapes, because we couldn't do football live when we started. And we were really, because of the constraints of Getty, and they didn't want to spend a lot of money if they didn't have to, the people who suddenly realized, wow, here's a way for me to get my story out. And so many of the negotiations were pretty simple. They'd come in and say, you know, they'd see the big rights fees paid by CBS or something, and they come to us and say, we want this money. And we'd say, no, it doesn't work that way. And in some cases, they actually paid us to put it on the air.
Wow.
So we had such good things as Irish hurling that you've mentioned. We had Australian rules football. But do you remember New York rooftop platform tennis?
No, I don't. That's one that escapes my memory.
And they wanted a big rights fee because they're in Manhattan. I don't know where they got that idea. But
well, it's anybody living in Manhattan. You know, they just think the world revolves around New York. So there you go.
You're right. They don't even go across the Staten Island.
That's right. If it's west of the Hudson, they don't care about it. So, but enough bashing of New York. Let me change subjects with you here, Bill, for just a minute. What are some of the unintended consequences, and they can be both positive or negative, the unintended consequences that ESPN has caused in America?
Well, a humorous one was we were on the air only about 6 months, and we were named in a divorce suit in a Texas court.
Really?
The wife said her husband discovered ESPN and wasn't paying attention to her and filed for divorce and named ESPN. And our lawyer, our general counsel, was, oh, woe is me, and our PR lady, who is still there to this day, by the way, Rosa Gatti, one of the most respected women in sports today, and she said, this is great, we're going to tell the world about it. And we did, and we got all kinds of publicity. So that's a bit on the humorous side. I think the most... The serious side is the way player salaries have escalated. A lot of people really point the finger at ESPN for glorifying athletes, for bringing more visibility and so on. And of course, they leave out the fact that, you know, Major League Baseball and football and so on have some responsibility for all that as well. But we were tarred with that brush. I have been... Personally, I've been to a couple of places and over the years where people have said, you know, you're the guy responsible. One guy did a survey, I forgot what it was, about the, what do you call it, the worst people in sports. And I was named at the top of the list because of putting all these salaries, just skewing them all out of whack.
Isn't that interesting?
But that's, you know, everybody has an opinion.
Oh, sure. Everybody does. And Bill, you might be interested in listening in tomorrow at 10:30. I'm going to have Dave Zirin, the Washington Post writer. He's going to be coming in. He's going to be talking about bad sports. Specifically, he's going to be addressing ownership's responsibility in all of this. But so that was an unintended consequence. Any other unintended consequences that come to mind?
No, not really. I think ESPN recently has been taking a lot of one of the early accusations was we were unabashedly self-promoting. Well, marketing is what it's all about. And when we had a product that we had to go out and tell people about, we really did it. I think early on, the Sports Center series, and even to this day, the Sports Center promos that they put on, they're good television. And depending on who is losing in the ratings battle or who is losing in the subscriber battle, they all tend to point a finger at ESPN. But ESPN is because, as you mentioned earlier, it's such a part of the culture now, it's really difficult to say, well, we don't want to watch those guys. We're going to go someplace else. If you really want to find out what's going on in sports, you have to live with ESPN and its many networks. Yeah. They have 52 networks now around the world.
Wow.
It's amazing.
That is incredible growth, explosive growth over the last 31 years. We're talking to Bill Rasmussen, everybody. Bill, we've only got a couple of minutes left, but you really have set the gold standard for startup media companies with ESPN. A lot of media pundits, though, are saying cable is over, old media is dying. What do you see as the new frontier where innovation is going to happen? Is it the Internet the next big thing for media?
I think so. Last fall, we did a series, an experimental series of 18 football games on the Internet, small college football games. It opened a lot of eyes. And literally, at this stage of the technology development, every campus, when you're thinking of college sports, and I suppose it could go down to some high schools as well, every campus can really be its own TV station. every single campus. Live streaming is available. Media players are available. It's all there. It takes a conference and several conferences, not only the big D1 conferences, but D2 and 3 and small NAIA conferences. They're already getting the idea. Let's put together a conference page, and all of our schools will be in there, and we can feature our own game of the week. We can do all this. And it's really very easy to do and very inexpensive equipment-wise compared to what starting the major network was several years ago.
No doubt. We're talking to Bill Rasmus and everybody. Bill, you're sort of downplaying it, but you are a perpetual, habitual entrepreneur. Tell us about your latest adventure, College Fans Sports Network.
Yes, some people call me serial entrepreneur.
That's Bill. What I was looking for, yes.
College Fans is ESPN, of course, does a tremendous job putting information out. But it's really difficult for the small schools, for the fans to get involved and so on, to, you know, put their own videos in. We did one of the games we did last year. We got sent it off to ESPN, and they put it up as their number 2 highlight of the day in their top 10. And I think, you know, the kids just went crazy about that something like that would happen. But College Fans has a homepage, if you will, for 1,450 four-year schools in the country. And every sport played at each of those 1,450 schools behind that homepage has a page for each of those sports. We have over 22,000 sports pages. And the reception, as soon as we added the live streaming last August, we started, it's just amazing. People are thirsty for information. We've created some widgets where people can send a widget to their grandmother or their parents or boyfriend or girlfriend, whatever it is, and they can follow the scores. We developed a system to enter scores as the schools are in progress, and it posts automatically. So there are a lot of positive things, all geared toward, you know, instant information, which is what the whole world seems to be these days. I'm reminded when you asked that question on, if you remember Y2K, and the world was going to fall apart and so on, and there was an editorial, or not an editorial, year-end story, the Wall Street Journal, that said, talking about accomplishments in the 20th century, and they said, in looking forward to the 21st century, look for every athlete with a number on his back to have his own television station.
It's so true.
I think we're getting close to it.
We are. We're getting close to it. Bill Rasmussen, tell people, if they're interested in learning more about you, where they should go to get that information.
Come to ESPNFounder.com, and you'll see lots of stuff. You might even recognize Chris Berman. You'll see the Sports Center set, lots of photos from Bristol, a lot of things there. And, of course, you can find the book, Sports Junkies Rejoice, there as well under Bill's books when you get to ESPNFounder.com.
We've been talking to Bill Rasmus and everybody, the founder of ESPN Sports. Bill, it has been an honor. Thank you so much for being part of Brainstorming with Billy the Brain.
Well, Bill, I really appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Thanks. Take care. Now, if you missed part or all of this interview, you can find my interviews archived on brainstormingonline.com, my website. That brings us to the end of another show. You've been listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. Join us every day, Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock here on KKZZ AM 14.